Hello again and welcome to NESG Radio Podcast. So good to have you on the call with us this morning, afternoon, evening, depending on your neck of the world. Welcome to another episode. And today we are celebrating the World Population Day. And our topic for today is empowering a growing nation, youth empowerment through population planning. Nigeria stands at a demographic crossroad with its youthful population offering both a tremendous opportunity and a potential challenge. As the nation's population continues to grow rapidly, the need for evidence-based planning has never been more urgent. Youth unemployment, skills mismatch, and limited access to economic opportunities are persistent issues. However, with effective population planning, these challenges can be transformed into a demographic dividend. And on today's episode, we are so glad to have with us a distinguished resource person who is a seasoned learning specialist and policy advisor with a strong track record of driving digital equity, inclusive education across Africa. His work spans global organizations such as the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, GIZ, Code.org, Abuja Chamber of Commerce, Facebook, now Meta, Microsoft Nigeria, through initiatives like Code to Earn. He has trained over 26,000 individuals in coding, equipping them with essential digital skills for the modern economy. He is a Chevening scholar and the thematic lead for the politics and governance group under the Community of Practice of Youth at the NESG. Please join me to welcome Mr. Oluwatobi Oseni. Mr. Toby, you're welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's really good to be here with you.
Awesome. Let's jump right into the conversation. So from your experience, because I see that you've gone across different and multiple global and local organizations, both within the country and offshore. From your experience, what are some of the most pressing challenges that young people face today in securing decent jobs?
So thank you so much. The way I like to look at this really is the first part of it, which is that a lot of young people, I mean, we are a really blessed country. We have a really large youth population. But unfortunately, a lot of young people who have, and I dare say this, you know, as also an employer of labor, is that the problem is that a lot of young people have degrees. I mean, credentials are great, but a lot of these credentials do not prepare them for the future of work. A lot of people have degrees in courses that have prepared them for jobs of yesterday. And I probably would use an example of even myself, for example. By background, I'm an accountant. And it means that I have training in accounting, but a lot of newer and younger firms today don't do the traditional bookkeeping with fiscal books and the rest of that. And unfortunately, that's what we're taught in school. And so if you try to get a job in a more modern company, it means that the company has to invest in training you. And unfortunately, the sad reality is that a lot of companies right now, because of the way the market is, cannot afford to start to train people, especially again because a lot of the jobs that exist in our market in Nigeria are really jobs with companies that are mid-sized to small SMEs, and so they don't have so much budget or even the capacity to actually train young people. And so that's one of the biggest problems. The biggest mismatch is that people have credentials, but these credentials, they are unable to translate this into actual work. One other problem that we currently have also is the fact that in cases where people want to transition from one job to the other, for a lot of the skills that that are most popular in our ecosystem, for example, it's difficult for people to adapt. And I would say that some of the challenges that people have had has also been structured learning in a lot of this. And that's why a lot of the programs that I've worked on in teaching people how to code, I've always said that, no matter what it is that we do, whether you are an accountant or even a music professional, there has to be the IT of everything. And unfortunately, this has not been a major part of our curriculum. I mean, it has been extensive work to try to bring in technology in education, but this has also, been one of the biggest problems that I have seen, that's affected young people getting into workplaces.
Thank you very much. And quite interesting that you mentioned the subject of adaptability and also the internet of everything. How do you then see the connection between population data and job creation through effective skills acquisition initiatives?
The Nigerian population is both a blessing and a curse. And this is what I mean by a blessing. A lot of young people, meaning that there's a lot of opportunity, but also translates to a ticking time bomb, if you let me use that word. It's an opportunity that if we do not manage, it becomes a very serious risk. And so the nexus between, you know, this young population and also economic development, I think is really very simple. One is that we need to look at the data and see, you know, what set of skill set do we have the most, and how can we then refine this skill set into what the economy can, or what can translate into, you know, input for the economic output eventually. And I think that we are also at a very important place, and this is because right now we've seen a lot of US government tariffs on a lot of countries, including China. And so it means that if we can get it right, we can start to shift some manufacturing. Interestingly, you know, Nigeria always has, you know, my friends in the diplomatic circles say Nigeria always has good relationship with the West, you know, unlike countries like China. And I dare say this also on this podcast. And so it means that in the nearest future, we might not, you know, face those kinds of tariffs or sanctions. And so it means that if we can also take good use of, you know, this opportunity, where companies want to start to manufacture outside of China, and then can move this manufacturing to maybe into Nigeria and take advantage of this growing youth population. The nexus really for this is that, well, we need to follow the data. What skill set do we have the most, like I said, and also how can we ensure that we are also a digitally enabled, economy. And one of the largest problems that businesses have always complained about has always been technology adaptation, and also the level of of technology adoption that one, the people and also the market has adopted. And one of the biggest and easiest ways for us to do this also is to perhaps, you know, engage in large scale knowledge sharing. We've seen a lot of these kinds of programs, you know, where we send people abroad for trainings and then bring them back. But I think that this has to be more institutional. Take for example, universities in Nigeria should have, maybe again, you know, most faculty should have a knowledge sharing system where, you know, they are affiliated to like invest in Korea, invest in the US, invest in advanced economies, where we can share knowledge. And not just because we want to send one or two professors, you know, to the US every semester to, you know, to go and learn, but to make this translate into actual learning for the people. And so it's beyond, you know, just sending the academics, but also, you know, allowing the people themselves who are learning. You know, there's a lot of value in sending students, for example, on exchange programs than there probably is in sending, you know, one professor who, you know, is 35 years into his practice, and there's just so much he can do when he's back, you know. And so I think that that's one of the most important parts of that. And I also think that Nigeria needs a very, very deliberate planning. These young people, including myself, you know, who have this skill set, a lot of them want to be led. And I say this because, again, on the internet, we see a lot of them, they jump on the next moving train. Oh, people are learning, you know, UI, UX right now. Everybody wants to learn it. People are learning maybe how to write code, front-end development. A lot of people are learning it, and they are not exactly sure what to do. And so that's where I think that there has to be deliberate planning. You know, the government has to give more structured options for people. And at this point, the government really has to treat human capital development, you know, as a crisis. And that's because you cannot have this many people out of job. And if you do not, you know, use data to guide these decisions, you really cannot make any progress with it.
Quite interesting that you mentioned population being both a blessing and a curse. And I hope for Nigeria, owing to the fact that we have good relationship with the Western world, can make this population boom a blessing for our country. My next question to you will be, how does population data help inform employment strategies and national development planning? And if you could please tell us what practical steps the government and civil society can take to ensure that population policies are inclusive and youth-centered.
Yeah, this is the way I look at it. You know, every unskilled youth rather, is a missed opportunity. Every trained youth is a national asset. The way we have to visit this is this: if you and I are not well trained, you know, the problem is that It means that even if we become teachers, we would, you know, instill this, you know, incomplete or bad knowledge that we have, or wrong knowledge that we have on the next generation. And so there is when, that is when there is a big problem. You know, the connection between data and national planning, very, very straightforward, you know, and also for inclusive education. One of the biggest problems that I know that we have, and interestingly, you know, as a person with disability myself, sometimes we get to forget that, you know, the society is made up of, you know, of everyone, you know, the able-bodied and the person with disability. And unfortunately, again, for people like myself who have non-visible disabilities, we tend to, you know, to forget, the society tends to forget that we also need to be catered for. And I think that one of the most interesting approach would even to be to make classrooms more accessible. I told someone something one time, and that it's been almost 10 years, and it still hasn't found results for me. And that's this. I've never walked into a bank in Nigeria, and I've seen an albino in a bank working in a bank. And I have gone to a lot of banks. I mean, I did study accounting. I work in fintech. So I think that I do visit quite a lot of banks. But I've never gone into a bank and seen someone on a wheelchair work in a bank. And so does it mean that we are saying that we want to only train the able-bodied people in the society? Does it mean that we want to disenfranchise this set of people in society? I mean, there's a lot of disability classes, yeah, people, you know, with low vision, you know, with our classrooms as you know, not even equipped for, you know, for people with great vision, let alone people with low vision. And so there is a big problem, and that, which is why, again, I said that, you know, we have to follow what the data says now. And now we have a real crisis. We have hundreds of thousands of people finish NYSE, you know, and they want to, we see a real problem. The problem being that people, you know, people go to university for 5-6 years, they study STEM, and, you know, and they come out and they, what they want to do is makeup. And this is really great. You know, you can start an enterprise in it, you know, but I'm sure that that's not why they probably went to school, you know, to study biochemistry for 6 years. And the gap that we have in healthcare, for example, has not been met. And as a matter of fact, I think that a lot of civil society organizations are doing a lot of work in also trying to bridge the gap, and especially where the government is lacking. But where I think there has to be a lot more pressure is also sensitizing the policymakers. And that's because a lot of policies really, at the textbook level, they are inclusive in the sense that, you know, they had one or two clauses there that says that, you know, there has to be XYZ in it. But I think that, you know, maybe we need to actually, you know, do a quota system. And this is what I mean. And maybe we have to say that in every classroom of 100 people, at least 30 people there must be people who identify as persons with disabilities. And so there has to be deliberate efforts to inclusion. You know, that's number one. Number two, there has to be deliberate efforts to ensure that, you know, more women, for example, are in STEM. I looked at the data of startup founders and startup leadership, and I realized that there's a lot more, you know, women in the management side of startups and a lot of, you know, emerging businesses than there are on the technical side. And I think that that is a very serious problem, because, you know, some of the most brilliant people in computer science are women. I mean, Ada of Lovelace was a woman, one of the first people to write codes, you know. And so if we do not start to bridge that gap, it means that we, you know, we don't have shining stars for younger women to look up to. And so for men, for example, you can easily say, oh, you know, there's this guy, you know, dear, mention names again, you know, there's the guys at Paystack, Shola and Ezra, and you can look up to them and say, oh, that's a man doing great stuff, you know. But who exactly do we want young women to look up to? Interesting, there are also very great women, you know, doing great stuff. For example, at Piggyvest, we have Odun at Piggyvest. But we need more people. We need more Odun in society. And the only way we can have more Odun is to include women a lot more in human capital development effort. And also at this point, we need to see civil society organizations not just put pressure on the government at the federal level for education, because again, in primary education, for example, you know, it's in the hands of other tiers of government. And so, of the other layers of government, rather. And so there's a need for us to do this, but also most importantly, ensure that private players in education are held accountable. And what I mean by that is we see a lot of private players in education, you know, they want to choose their own direction. And sometimes this is good because, you know, they're able to tailor, you know, what their output. but it's also bad because they tend not to be supervised. And so civil society organizations can start to hold everyone accountable, the government, the private players, and also ensure that we are able to, you know, to drive that change that it is that we want from that side.
Thank you very much. And I got some new, every unskilled youth is a missed opportunity. Every skilled youth is a national asset. Did I get that quote right?
Yes, you got that correct.
Amazing quote. Can you speak more to non-visible disability? You mentioned a concept known as non-visible disability. Can you speak a little bit on that?
Yes, absolutely. I would share a little bit of my story. I had an accident about 11 years ago, and so I did fracture a part of my face. Probably if you've seen pictures of me, you'll see some surgery marks on my face. And so I had a condition known as cerebral atrophy, which is because, you know, when I fell, my skull pressed on my brain and all of that. And then I've had a couple of operation surgeries to take care of that. But there are a lot of non-visible disabilities apart from cerebral atrophy. For example, HIV/AIDS is a non-visible disability now. There's a lot more non-visible disability, like loss of vision, you know, people with color blindness. And why some of these things are major problems is that in our classrooms, for example, and I'll give you one example because I don't see colors on one of my eye. In a regular Nigerian classroom, if I go to a government school, on days like this, I hear it's raining right now in Nigeria, on days like this when it is raining and, you know, it's quite cloudy and dark, you know, during the day, the classes would be monochrome in the sense that there will be only two or three colors in the classroom. And that's because, you know, it's cloudy. And so people with color blindness can not separate those colors properly. And so whatever the teacher is writing with chalk on the board, they cannot see it. And the unfortunate part of it is that because they don't want to be labeled in the class, they don't want to be, you know, put aside, they will try to string along. And imagine that happens on a day or on a week when they are teaching the most important part of the term. You know, maybe it's a math class and, you know, they are teaching the toughest part in algebra at that time. And, you know, he misses out on that. You know, unfortunately, that student has, you know, no access to extra classes. And so he misses out on that. His grades are poor. And that can be the beginning of, you know, of something else. But also because of the fact that as a people, we don't do enough testing. A lot of people have argued that Nigeria has low rate of autism, and I just think that Nigeria really is not testing enough. And so there are a lot of people who, for example, we see people being, you know, who have been said that they maybe do not understand math. Yes, some people are more analytical than the other, but does not mean that anybody cannot learn math, for example. You know, and that's probably because, you know, this person requires additional, you know, additional support. It could be autism, it could be dyslexia. And, you know, a lot of these conditions, they go undiagnosed. And so people are in classrooms and the teacher does not even know how to support them. And again, because I am a children scholar, I you know, wrote a paper on building the assistive technologies for persons with learning disabilities, and I have realized that even very interesting cases like people with loss of hearing. So imagine a classroom, I'll just paint you a picture here. So imagine a classroom with maybe 500 students, and this is a university classroom because my classroom in Lautech was that large. We have about 500 students, you know, students in accounting, and there's somebody with loss of hearing who is short and who is shy, you know, and so the person is just maybe seated somewhere.
People tried it.
Exactly. Mm. You know, and the teacher cannot, you know, the teacher's voice definitely cannot get to the back of the class, you know. And so in some cases, people have multiple disabilities, you know. And so it means that person is just disenfranchised. He's going to graduate with a 2-2 or a third class, or he struggled to get a 2-1 or even a first class. But it could have been better, you know. It could have been way better. This person could have felt included. And because the first part of learning is to open the mind, and if you cannot open anyone's mind, I don't think you can. But I also think that the real solution to this really is that the future should really not be predicted for young people. You know, it should be co-designed with them. And so the people who make these policies, the people who build these policies, should consider these different parts of it.
Quite interesting that you're moving in this direction. If you don't mind, I'll put a question so that we can put it more into context. Let me add some more context to that. Thank you so much for this enlightenment about non-visible disability. Before you speak about what government should do, how can Nigeria move from, you know, just data collection to actual data culture, one where data is routinely used to design, implement, and monitor youth-focused employment policy and other issues that affect young people in the country?
Most important part of data is transparency. People need to trust the data, and perhaps the government needs to really publish the data more often. And this is how people would trust, and people would then be able to also co-build with the government. I'll give you one example. In many sectors, when the government says that we have, let me use agriculture, for example, when the government says Nigeria is not producing enough rice, people see opportunity in it, and then they do what? They start to produce rice because they see a business opportunity in it. If the government really publishes more data that I believe that the government has access to and the government collect, it starts to allow more players join the government in building in national development. And the first part of it really should be, we have a youth population, and so policies should be youth focused. You know, it should be evidence based. And one of the biggest problems we currently have, I mean, we've not even had a census in a really long time. You know, the president recently said we were 240 million. You know, some of us work with population as 200 million. And so there are, you know, there are multiple angles to this. There's me saying something, there's the government saying something. And so we need to also be able to say that as a government, that every time our lawmakers make policies, it has to be data driven. We should not be making policies right now. We should be making more policies on the future of work. I mean, everybody is building AI right now. A lot of very interesting startups and companies that I have seen building interesting stuff in AI. You know, but you've barely seen any of that come from our own country. And maybe by extension, the continent. And also because, you know, nobody is looking at how we can start to solve this problem. But most importantly, there's one interesting thing I used to say to people, which is that, you know, as a people, we've been eating eba and semo for the longest. You know, and there's really no actual machine designed by us, you know, to make these things, to automate, you know, these things. And so it means that the government needs to start to see that we can co-create solutions, you know, challenge societies using this data to see how we can solve solutions in individual societies. And again, civil society, you know, does have a lot of role to play in this, you know, to see that we can take this data and then translate them into getting actual results from them.
Thank you very much. In light of Nigeria's informal economy, because we, you know, seem to have a larger informal sector than the formal sector in Nigeria, and then there's a lot of issue around underemployment in our country, how can population planning help us to formalize job pathways and strengthen our labor market structures?
I think that's a very tricky one and interesting one at the same time. We have a very informal economy, but they are solving key parts of the economy. And this is very evident. You know, we have people who make shoes or who maybe, for example, repair shoes. And it means that there's an opportunity there. They can start to make shoes. We have people who sew bags, for example. They can be small businesses like we've seen in China. You know, they can be small businesses, they can start to employ skilled people, and they can start to transform that knowledge. Now we can gradually move that informal economy to a more formal economy, one by using a lot of new technology. So imagine that, and then I'll give you one interesting example. Imagine that a manufacturer in Nigeria who maybe makes maybe energy drink. Let me just say somebody who makes maybe fruit juice on maybe a street in maybe K2 or Jota or something in Lagos State. You know, if they start to use more advanced equipment for what they do, you know, locally fabricated equipment, it means that they can start to scale. But the only way they can add this knowledge to their production line is because, is because now they are bringing in people who have this knowledge. You know, but unfortunately, we have mechanical engineers who can barely build, you know, any mechanical equipment. And so it means that it's difficult for us to then translate, you know, these skill sets, this academic skill set, into solving real life problems. And again, comes back to what I said earlier about capacity development. We need to be able to move beyond credentialism, you know, into solving actual real life problems. And That means that, for example, our problems are unique. Our problems are different from, for example, the problems of China, the problems of the United States. And until we can start to solve each of these problems using, this academic knowledge, it will be difficult for us to actually move from, unskilled labor to that. But also, most importantly, we need to also train more people on what I would call business leadership. Why I say this is because a lot of businesses in Nigeria, they usually die at the first generation. And so there are a lot of unskilled labor. And a lot of that, for example, are led by one or two man business, family-led businesses and a lot of these things, which are great, but they really don't scale beyond the first generation. And if we are able to bring, that academic knowledge into this, I strongly believe that we can, create a bridge to this problem and ensure that businesses, can employ more young people and start to use these modern technologies, to scale up and increase productivity.
Thank you very much. The theme for this year's World Population Day, as defined by the UN, is empowering youths to build the families they want. In your opinion, how can young people themselves lead the charge in advocating for fair and hopeful futures?
So for us as young people, the ball really is in our hands. And I think the first part of it is participation. I like to see it as a theory piece, people, participation and power, participation in governance itself. I've seen a lot of young people want to distance themselves from government and say that, they are technocrats, they are, in other sectors, they don't want to do that. But I think that the first part of contributing to national development is participation. Participation means actual participation, like running for office, for example, or policy formation, or even the great work that, the guys at the NESG, for example, do. And also one important part of it, which is holding leaders accountable. You cannot, if you ask someone to co-design a future with you, you must be able to hold them accountable. And I'd use, a family setting, for example. Imagine a family setting where there's a little more democracy, where we can say that, let's review what we did last year and see what did not work and what worked. And then to put more energy on what worked and to see how we can correct what did not work to ensure that, we can learn from mistakes of yesterday. And that's what really needs to happen. Young people have the power, and so they must participate. And that's because if you cannot leave a process and say you are not satisfied with the outcome. The only way you can ensure that works is that you are a part of, ensuring that the outcome is the way you want it to be. But also, there has to be a lot of youth-led advocacy. We need a lot more young people who believe more in Nigeria. We need to, as a people, we need to be patriotic. And I'll probably, compare, I don't want to compare, again, some societies with ours, because again, every society is unique. Mm. But I think that as a people, we need to show more love, and understanding for the change or the process that it is that we want. And I say this because I know a lot of young people, sometimes myself included, we've lost hope in certain parts of the country, but that doesn't mean that, you don't contribute your bit. And by contributing, I mean we need to understand that we are at a very, 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 very critical stage. And countries that have been at this stage, they've been able to, to mold this into something better. And so it means that, like Aliko Dangote said, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, Nigeria is 5 years from being a great nation. So it means that if collectively as young people, I'd use the popular word, if we lock in, as young people, it means that in 5 years we really can be a really great country. Who would have thought that we could have a refinery, in that short period? The government has been trying to get a refinery to work in over 60 years. In my lifetime, none of the government refineries worked. And now, a private individual, Aliko Dangote, was able to make refinery work. So it means that many other sectors that we think that, cannot work, they are easy to fix. And a lot of the problems that it is that we think that the society faces, or a lot of the manufacturing gaps, a lot of young people can start to bridge those gaps. But also, but I think we are doing so well in it, social entrepreneurship, we are doing a lot of digital activism, but we need to hold the government more accountable. We need to ensure that the theory piece work collectively as a people, we participate, and then we show that power really belongs to the people.
interesting, and I love your three piece. I know we're running a bit out of time, so I will ask you two questions in one as a final question before I come to your closing thoughts. And this, my last question to you would be, as we look towards 2030 and beyond, what does a smart population policy look like? And how can young people, or what one major recommendation would you make in terms of reform to ensure that Nigeria fully taps into its youthful population potential?
How can Nigeria tap into its youthful population? I'll start with that bit of it. The most important part right now, is human capital development. We need very aggressive human capital development, right? We need to do it so much that people would say we are doing too much. You know, that's the kind of aggressive approach we should have to. Like, we need people to complain that we are doing too much. You know, but we cannot do that if we don't co-create solutions. It means that we need to see that we can bring everybody to the table and say, what do we want to achieve, you know, short-term and long-term as a country? Do we want to be a technology-focused country? Do we want to drive solutions in that? And to see that we have a common purpose for that period and say, over the next 20 years, we want to be a superpower for manufacturing. Over the next 20 years, we want to be a superpower for innovation. And then we can start to use the data to guide a lot of these skills. But again, like I said, if the people do not trust the data, they cannot work with it. And which is why one of the most important things that I would recommend is to, you know, establish a National Youth Economic Intelligence Council that will take into account, you know, the youth population. And I understand that, you know, we have a lot of committees, a lot of agencies that really are not, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. But this would allow young people, you know, to see planning that is focused on them. We make up the employment market. We make up the emerging market. We make up the, you know, the next set of voters. And so that means that, you know, the future really is in our hands, and there has to be something that we can look to say that we understand these policies, we are part of these policies. You know, we need to know somebody directly. Every young person needs to be able to point to somebody in their circle who is a part of national development. And so what that means is that we need to bring this down to the lowest level. It means that somebody in K2, for example, knows somebody who, and this is not, you know, for nepotism or anything, but there's somebody who we can directly look up to say, oh, I know, you know, Tunde who is part of, you know, the economic development, and I trust, you know, that Tunde is doing great work to ensure that there's national development. And there's the only way we can do that really is that your output really is, I mean, input equals to output. The quantity of knowledge that people can give out equals to the quantity of knowledge that they have. And so if you want any economy to be developed, you need to bridge that knowledge gap. And bridging that knowledge gap is the most important part of us doing this.
Thank you so much, Mr. Oluwatobi, for an amazing and insightful podcast session. It's been interesting having this conversation on empowering a growing nation, youth empowerment through population planning. And you've been listening to Oluwatobi Oseni, our resource person for today. Till we come your way next time, remember that Nigeria is just 5 years away from being a great nation. That's a personal mantra that I'm taking out of this conversation. And a quote that our distinguished panelists left with us today to think about is that every unskilled youth is a missed opportunity, and every skilled youth is a national asset. So we'll come your way again next time on the NESG Radio Podcast. Keep being great. Happy World Population Day. Thank you.